Good morning and welcome to Smashy Business. I'm Lubna Hamdan. And
morning, Waleed Shihabi here. Ramadan Kareem, everybody.
Ramadan Kareem, Waleed. How's it going?
It's going all right. Not bad. I'm back on the program. Basically, I was shamed back into it by my sons.
Yes,
absolutely.
Into fasting, you mean?
Into fasting, absolutely.
Shamed into fasting. That's brilliant. My dad tries to do that with me. He succeeded several times, but.
We're on that experiment right now, and apologies if I'm not on point today, but getting there.
No worries, it's for a good cause.
Absolutely.
Right? So, let's quickly go through the news headlines, and then we'll talk about an interesting topic we were just discussing before we went live. OpenAI is a lie, according to Elon Musk. He always just throws something out there and it just becomes the news. Anything he says is interesting. He's also open sourced his chatbot. We'll talk about that next. And then we've got the right person in the studio with us today to talk about this. Sharjah rents are on the rise. The Emirates real estate market has seen $844 million in transactions and sales transactions this February. And then Airbnb's secret cameras scandal. The rental platform has introduced new rules to protect consumers. And then up next, stay with us for the interview with our guest, lawyer Shai Zamanian. He's a U.S. lawyer helping people not only get an education in the U.S., but also retire there through the golden visas. But we're going to talk about limited options for retirement in the GCC. Stay tuned. Waleed, we were discussing an interesting point that you made, that your siblings chose to study abroad in the UK. You were encouraged, putting it politely, encouraged to stay in Beirut, to go to Beirut, because you were born and raised here in the UAE, and you went to university there.
Correct. We were talking a little bit about college education.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was because I was a black sheep of the family, but yeah, I was the one that did not go to the UK to study. I mean,
considering how well you've done in your career.
Thank you very much. That's
very
kind. Black
sheep, what do your siblings do? Wow.
No, but it was actually something I don't regret at all. I studied at the American University of Beirut. We like to call it the Harvard of the Middle East. I don't know if it lives up to that moniker, but certainly one of the most beautiful campuses in the world, and a real world experience for me during that time. That was back in the 90s, early days after Lebanon came out of the Civil War. So it was a very rich experience for sure.
Yeah.
So I didn't get the UK education, but I think I got something of a very well-rounded one at the American University of Beirut, and it is an American education system, so a little bit related to what you were talking about
right.
The American education standards and so on.
And how they've dropped, yeah, absolutely.
And yes, how they've dropped appeal, I think.
Yeah.
I think there's more options out there, obviously, in the world, but there's also some baggage that comes with studying in the U.S. I think people are considering more and more these days.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And you know what? I just find it endearing studying in the country of your origin. You're Palestinian Lebanese.
Correct.
There's something endearing about going back home and getting that college university experience.
Absolutely. And today I would definitely second that. At the age of 17, I maybe not necessarily think so. It was a bit of a shock back in 1993 to go to a post-war Lebanon after having been brought up a little bit sheltered over here in Dubai. But looking back at it, it was a brilliant experience for sure.
Surely it made you stronger as a person. And
I believe so. It exposed me to something a little bit different than what I was used to, and opened me up a little bit more, if you want, on different points of view, on the craziness of politics, the craziness of the region overall, and what happens here, on a broader sense. And it did introduce a degree, I think, of maturity also in
Absolutely.
The way I saw things.
I mean, it's real life, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to, as much as we love the UAE and we love Dubai, it's sometimes you feel like you're living in a bubble.
Yeah, I mean, things are generally work well here. They generally don't work well everywhere else in the in the world.
So you need to be sheltered here, as you said.
Correct. So you need to be prepared to dealing with adversity and dealing with environments where things don't go smoothly. Don't have a lot of friction involved, and at least know how to deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, I've never actually left the UAE, but when I go to Moscow, I experience real life, and it's great. Sometimes you just you need to get that experience.
Absolutely. New perspective, new environment, and just test yourself on how you can adapt to that new environment and maybe even thrive.
Absolutely. Speaking of new environments and new realities, it's all about AI. Right.
I don't know if it's all about AI or all about Elon Musk, but yes.
Oh, but what a great line. It's always about it's just Elon Musk's world and we're all just living in it, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating. And he'll always make the headlines, I think, for the foreseeable future, especially that he's taking a full dive into the AI space. It's not like he wasn't involved before. He was one of the first investors in OpenAI. And that's what I think also gives him a degree of right to comment on this. And I think it's within the biggest debate, mostly within the geek sector, if you like,
right,
of the people actually working on the on the AI product, on whether people have the right to control what's in there versus making it an open source sort of platform. And obviously Elon Musk falls on the open source.
Absolutely.
Side.
Let's give people a little context. So Elon Musk, as usual, tweeted something interesting yesterday. He announced that he's going to, that his AI startup will open source Grok, which is the chat GPT challenger. And then someone responded saying OpenAI should do the same. And then Elon Musk responded saying OpenAI is a lie. Let me give you guys some background. So after he accused Sam Altman's OpenAI of being a lie, it was another public feud. It wasn't the first. The Microsoft-backed company was set up. He helped set it up in 2015, as you were mentioning, Waleed.
As a nonprofit, by the way.
As a nonprofit, exactly. I'm getting to that, but thank you. He sued the company earlier this month for ditching its nonprofit strategy. Not entirely, but they opened a for-profit subsidiary. So the move to open source Grok could offer the public free access to experiment with the technology's code. However, he's saying that it's not a good move for OpenAI. He's saying it should not have opened its for-profit subsidiary. But then there were emails shared by OpenAI where Elon Musk was actually talking about turning it into a cash cow. So really, I feel like he's just doing this for publicity.
Absolutely. And it always works, I guess.
He did that with Twitter and Al-Waleed as well.
The more inflammatory it is, the more traction it's going to get, and keeps him front and center in terms of the conversation, I guess. And the most important conversation today is what are the rules of AI?
Yeah.
Right? How is it going to be built? And, we're getting deeper and deeper into the wormhole, I think, in the conversation. And it's one of those difficult things that it will determine a lot of your life in the future, this conversation. And yet I think most people are not equipped to take part in it.
Great point. And I mean, can we really take part in it? I guess with Gen Z, they really are a force to be reckoned with. I think a lot of people were underestimating them.
Absolutely.
But even when it comes to the boycotts, when it comes to Gaza, for example, they've really taken a strong stance. And they've really, I think someone from Starbucks, I can't remember if it was the CEO or not, he said, well, they're not going to care. They're still going to want to drink their frappuccinos. Mm-hmm. And they were really insulted.
They were offended, of course.
They were offended.
I don't know if it's a unitary body, Gen Z's, but certainly it's a generation that wants to be heard and wants to be part of the decision.
Yeah.
And I think it's the most enabled generation there's ever been.
Absolutely. And the most tech savvy as
well. And certainly the most tech savvy. And they're digitally native. They were born into this, unlike us, maybe, that were sort of changed our habits in order to become a little bit more digitally enabled. This generation was born into it.
Right.
And I think that gives them a lot of power. And I think they will push to be a bigger part of this decision of where AI takes us. I think a lot of the policy around AI is built by people who don't really understand it, or is trying to be put in place by a lot of people who don't understand it. And I just hope that it takes the better for humanity route rather than the other one. Do I have a very firm opinion on what that looks like? I'm afraid not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, it'll be really interesting. But I think the what's even more interesting than the AI conversation is the fact that Elon Musk always just, you know, puts a statement out there, and then gets, you know, it gets proven wrong, and something comes out, you know, like these emails, you know, and it was so blatant, right? He literally called it a cash cow, right? But people still love him, and he still does the same thing over and over. He has no shame in the game.
I have to admit, I'm one of those people, and I think it's just a person that's just established so much credibility, right? Even in context of him saying something that is instantly sort of negated in words that he's had, but the results speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. To be able to disrupt so many core industries globally, to have, you know, to have defined the electric car and the EV eco-space, while at the same time creating new technology in space, and at the same time giving internet to everybody, and it's mind-boggling, and which means that his opinion always matters.
Absolutely.
In whatever topic his opinion is on, and it's just the side I fall on this. I think it's obvious that his attack on OpenAI is because he's going to compete with OpenAI, and he is competing with OpenAI, and I think it's fair game.
Yep, absolutely. Brilliant. And speaking of opinions that matter, you're the perfect co-host today because we're going to talk about Sharjah rents. They're on the rise. The sales transactions this February hit $844 million. There's a lot of demand now for Sharjah real estate. It was the case, you know, the past couple of years, that was the case because a lot of people were working in Dubai, but living in Sharjah. I remember we had, you know, we were working with photographers who were renting out, you know, two-bedroom apartments for their families in Sharjah for, you know, close to nothing, really, compared to Dubai rents.
Much more affordable, yes.
Much more affordable. But that's changing, isn't it?
Well, it's. I think there's a spillover effect, obviously. I think of Sharjah as part of the extended urban area of Dubai, and Ajman, by the way, also. Mm. It's an extended urban area. There's no real major distance between them. There's traffic, obviously.
Right.
But what that means is that the performance of Dubai real estate will always have an impact on Sharjah real estate. Mm-hmm. It will always spill over. Mm-hmm. And we've seen prices go up, transactions go up in Dubai. We've seen a population growth in Dubai. We've seen rents, obviously, go up. And you've mentioned, you know, the friction that's caused a lot of people, especially when they're renewing their rents at higher rates and so on. But it will naturally spill over to the to Sharjah, while also at the same time Sharjah having its own economy. And its own industries and so on that also are growing at this time. So these two effects will naturally mean that people will look to Sharjah as a more affordable option, not just for renting, but for acquiring real estate and for investing in real estate. And I think that is natural. What's happened in Sharjah more recently is also that the quality of developments has improved and the volume of developments has improved. So you've seen a big investment in sort of master communities in Sharjah where you didn't have that before, and that in itself has attracted a lot of attention.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that the prices last year, they rose 10 to 25%. That's a big increase. The spillover effect you were talking about. Do you think that they're going to continue to rise in Sharjah, the prices, or do you think? Because there are talks of you know, the prices kind of settling down a little bit in Dubai?
There is talk of that. There is no actual proof of that yet.
I highly doubt it, to be honest.
I think net, the impact is still to the upside. Right now, there is talk of obviously new supply coming into the market that can take a little bit of steam off. S&P just issued in a report yesterday, actually, on Dubai real estate, that they do expect the market to tail off in 2024. I think that takes into account supply that may or may not be handed over in the timeline that they expect.
Right.
Obviously, global headwinds come into question. There is pressure on the global economy. We've had high interest rates for around 2 to 3 years now.
Yeah.
And that's a long, prolonged period where things are more expensive, right? Where borrowing is more expensive, where expectations of return are higher. And these things can and should have an effect on pricing in Dubai, but I don't see it manifesting in 2024, to tell you the truth. From where we're looking, supply isn't big enough for that to happen. In 2024, maybe 2025 onwards. So I don't think we're going to see the gains continue at the same rate that we've seen in terms of pricing. In terms of rent, we'll continue to see that go up, actually, because especially because they're allowed to now more than they were previously because of the new rental index. And I think the impact on Sharjah will continue to be positive. And I think we're going to have a positive year both on prices and rents in Sharjah.
And you had a comment about something we said on yesterday's show. RERES index was updated.
Correct.
And the CEO of Better Homes was kind of giving his predictions on the matter. And he said, tenants who have been renting for 2 years, the rent prices will now increase for them.
May increase for them. Mm. And that's the thing. It's what the index allows you to do. As a landlord and tenant, you negotiate. But then the terms of this negotiation is set now by the RERA index, right? Your landlord might choose, you're a great tenant, you pay on time, everything's good, you know, might choose to just extend the tenancy with you at the same at the same rate. But the rights of the property owner now have been expanded a little bit, or not expanded, I think improved to some degree, because our criticism of the previous rental index was that it was an extremely blunt instrument. And it used to price property by area.
Right.
So regardless of whether the property that you're renting is a very high premium sort of product, or it's an old and unattended property, they used to be treated the same, even though the market treats them very differently. Rent in one could be three times as high as rent in the other in the open in the open market, and that wasn't being addressed by the rental index. What the new index allows, it's a little bit of a sharper instrument right now. It takes into consideration the unit itself, the building itself, or the community itself where that property is at, and allows more flexibility for resetting pricing by the property investor. Now, net, will it have a higher rental price impact or a lower one? It will have a higher one, most most likely, given what's happening in the market. Bad news for tenants, possibly, but good news for landlords, because landlords were complaining of this extremely blunt instrument. Remember, we have hundreds of thousands of property owners in Dubai that invest in this.
And boy, do I wish I was one of them.
Well, you know, it's never
right
too
now.
Late. I would, I would say, but it's one of those asset classes, right? That people save money through, right?
Absolutely.
It's a wealth preservation. It's a savings instrument that people use. And in the case of, for example, my parents, it's a retirement instrument. They live off investments they've made over decades in, you know, individual properties and the rent that pays them their retirement effectively right now. And a lot of people treat it that way. We mentioned that interest rates are higher in the last couple of years. So if these properties were bought on mortgage, etc., the cost on these investors has gone up. right?
Sure, sure.
So there is an argument also there in terms of the cost that they're bearing, that it needs to be recovered.
It is a great point that you made about, you know, properties being priced according to the areas and how unfair you know that is towards property owners. That's you know understandable, and it's actually great to get this from the point of view of a landlord. So you own property, so it's great to kind of get that because it's usually you know people are not usually happy with their landlords. Let's put it bluntly, right?
Correct, but it's a problem to be solved. Also, the nature of the relationship with landlords, the clarity of laws and rules, how things are dealt with, and I think that's a little bit where Keeper, which we started a few years ago, comes in. Is that it sort of bridges that that divide. It educates the tenant and the landlord on the market, on the rules, and so on, and hopes to reach a point where that relationship is a positive one. It doesn't it doesn't have to be a confrontational one. In a lot of cases, actually, it's an extremely positive one. But at the very least, it's a clean contractual business relationship.
Absolutely.
That needs to be dealt as such. So, you know, all these property investors that have accumulated properties or bought properties or invested in properties now have tools to use to help them act professionally and in an informed manner when it comes to renting out their properties.
Speaking of acting professionally, Airbnb has had the secret camera scandal. There's always some sort of scandal when it comes to Airbnb.
Correct.
So they've introduced new rules to protect consumers. This is after reports that Airbnb renters found hidden cameras in properties. So the short-term rental platform announced that hosts now have to disclose any use of indoor cameras in common areas, but it banned their placement in bathrooms and sleeping areas, which you would think would make sense.
Yes, I hope.
It said in a blog post that most of its listings on the platform don't feature indoor cameras. Of course, they're going to say that. But they also added rules for outdoor cameras and noise monitors as well. And they banned cameras in private outdoor areas like saunas, which also you would think makes sense as well.
Of course. It's now about enforcement and implementation, right? So Airbnb doesn't manage these properties. It advertises them,
right?
And that's always the challenge that they will have, is that they don't have full control over what happens in these properties, their condition, etc.
And so don't take full responsibility as well.
They should take some responsibility, obviously. They're marketing these properties. They're processing the bookings and the payments, they're dealing with the guests and so on. Certainly, this is something that they should address and they should escalate. This shouldn't be something that, you know, catches them by surprise.
Yeah.
But I just wonder how effective enforcement is on that. There's a lot of professional managers on the Airbnb platform that have certain standards that they adhere to and would never dream of doing that sort of thing. But it's what happens when they do, when this is discovered. How is the host or the property owner or the person running the property disincentivized from ever thinking of doing something like that? And how do you escalate this issue?
It's a big issue, right?
It's a huge issue to imagine
that you are, you know, renting out an Airbnb and someone has put hidden cameras in there.
And understanding that that's a risk that you take. But there are ways of dealing with it. So if I recommend to a consumer, I would tell them, look at the host, look at the reviews. Airbnb gives you a lot of good tools to use in order to understand the property, people's previous experiences in the property, how that landlord has behaved before. It gives you a lot of indicators on whether or not this is a property that you wanna book and you can trust with something like that. And other than that, be diligent. Right. Don't assume that, you know, it's being managed professionally by people with certain standards. Make sure for yourself. So check, the hidden areas.
It's tough out there.
It's tough
out
there. That's
it's true. Tough out there. Life is getting tougher by the day. Right. Thank you so much, Waleed, for your input today. A brilliant conversation, as always.
Thank you. And really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. And up next, stay tuned. We've got lawyer Shay Zamanyan. He helps individuals and families not only get an education in the U.S., helps them get the golden visa, and also helps them retire there. He says options for retirement are limited in the GCC. Let's see if we can agree to disagree on that one. Lawyer Shay Zamanyan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us in the studio. Ramadan Kareem.
Thank you, you as well.
And I want to give you an introduction, but I prefer you introduce yourself.
Sure.
Because from what I understand, you helped people get golden visas to the U.S. It was a big deal during the Trump Muslim ban. And you helped them get education and also retire there. You say options are limited in the GCC. That is what we'd like to focus on, and that is what
Let's
you focus
it.
On. Yeah?
Let's do it. Yeah, we can talk about all of that. So in terms of my background, I moved here about 11 years ago.
Okay.
I came here sight unseen, didn't have friends or family. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to bring this idea and this concept and bring it to a new region?
You came from the U.S., yeah?
I came from the U.S. Yep. So I finished my studies in law. I finished my doctorate in law, passed the bar exam, worked a part of an in-house counsel team at the nation's largest home developer in the U.S., where I learned a lot of interesting tools. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to go abroad and educate people on new concepts coming from America, one of which was the concept of the golden visa, whereby you can invest in America, and by virtue of the investment, you can have an expedited path to U.S. residency.
Can we explain that real quick for viewers who don't know what the golden visa is?
Sure. So over 30 years ago, back in 1990, the U.S. Congress created a program. In fact, Biden was in Congress at the time it was created. So they wanted
He's that old, right?
He is an old man, yeah. Let's see if he makes it into another term. With that said, so he was a part of a bigger group that created this idea where they wanted to create an opportunity for foreigners to invest and take a chance on America, create jobs, add to the economy, and by virtue of making that investment, they can have an expedited path or a quick path in becoming a U.S. person. So we do have a good contingency of people from the GCC. They've moved here. They have a great life, as you and I do here, which is fantastic.
Right.
Ultimately, they're seeking different things in terms of establishing a nationality, a second nationality from the West, educating their kids. I think access to education at bigger institutions is important for a lot of people living in the GCC. And for some of these reasons, they will undertake this program. They will make an investment in America. By virtue of that investment, we do their government filings.
What is the range of that investment?
So the minimum amount is $800,000. And they are in pre-approved sort of government projects, government pre-approved projects, sorry, generally in the real estate realm. So again, I've been here for about 11 years. I'll give you an idea of what previously my investors have invested in. So the Ritz-Carlton, New York City, it's now complete. Back in 2018, a lot of the construction financing came through investors from the GCC.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose to invest in that project. We did their sort of filing with Washington, D.C. and coordinated with the embassy in Abu Dhabi, and we were able to get them to become U.S. people.
A lot of people from the GCC did the same thing in Egypt, right? They went and they got education in Egypt and also invested in hotels and properties and land there. But sorry, go ahead.
I sense within the region it's not sort of a brand new idea because you do have this market where nationalities are traded and sold. Mm. That kind of is a place here in Dubai especially. We're happy to help all types of nationalities. It's, you know, there is no nationality that's barred. So so long as you have a clear source of funds, you can prove up sort of how you made your money, you know, the U.S. isn't discerning on what your particular background is. So it's been quite successful, and we've had good success from the GCC. We've filed the most applications from the region, and we hope to continue to be a thought center when it comes to this topic.
Is there a particular country in the GCC that is the most, where there is the most demand for that?
So we do have, for example, a lot of Indian clients. That mm-hmm. could be for a number of reasons. One, it could reflect just the demographic of the UAE and Dubai, and in that we have the most Indian clients.
Sure.
It could also be, you know, other factors whereby I know specifically, you know, Indians do have the dream of aspiration of their kids going to Ivy League schools in the U.S. and willing to sort of sacrifice for them. Although that could be true for perhaps all nationalities within the region. But, you know, to answer your question, I would say about half of our clients are of Indian nationality. I would say upper middle class. You know, they're not usually in the highest sort of bracket of earners. You know, a set of parents, at least one of them perhaps even works as a salary earner, mm-hmm. has created a little bit of wealth, and knows that ultimately he's got a set of kids that want to be educated in the U.S. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, financially, does it really make sense to do the program?
Yeah.
Because it does sound like a big amount of money, $800,000 being invested for a period of about 5 or 6 years with the expectation of that funds being returned to you.
I mean, I guess in Dubai, when you mentioned that number, it's not really a big number, right? Considering the investments people are putting into real estate.
We were talking earlier about rents and everything else.
Yeah.
So Dubai is an interesting place because, yes, okay, $800,000 is a lot of money, but you know, it's been such a wonderful springboard for you and I and a lot of people to be making a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, this conversation is a bit more ripe here than mm-hmm. perhaps in other places. But in terms of finances, so if someone knows that they have at least one child looking to study in the U.S., the prices are astronomical, right? You've got tuition, housing, books, transportation, all these things, if you were to add it up in time, you know, could sort of get into that ballpark.
Yeah.
And so by virtue of doing this program and becoming U.S. people, the U.S. government steps in the shoes of parents mm-hmm. and helping to pay for tuition, housing, books, mm-hmm. transportation. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has a national policy that they want to ensure every student has equal footing in accessing education, whether the parents can pay for it or not. So we have a lot of families that come to us with the dream that their kids will ultimately want to study or know that they're going to study in the U.S., and they set them up so that at least they won't be out of pocket for those educational expenses.
Sure, sure. That's great. And I mean, you know, student debt is another whole other topic that we can talk about maybe on another episode. But have you seen a decline in the demand to, you know, opt for an American education, considering, you know, politically, economically, the U.S. is not at its best right now? There's still, you know, the education is still high. Obviously, a lot of people have a lot of high regard for the educational institutions there. But cost of living, generally, politically, the situation is not that great. You've got a lot of riots, people feel unsafe, etc. Has that affected the business? Has it affected the demand?
You're right. So the U.S. isn't in a place that it was coming out of, say, World War II. Dynamics have changed. Global powers have been shifting. There is a resurgence in Asia, right? Mm-hmm. We've had China be more dominant than they had been in decades before. There is this clash of civilizations. So, but I don't think anyone's getting in line to send their kids to the University of Shanghai. Sure, there could be exceptions. But I still think the Western ideal and, you know, the ability to create independent thinkers, if it wasn't for that type of education, I wouldn't be here before you today. I came from a war-torn nation. And it was the decisions that my parents made in taking us out from a conflicted region to the U.S. that allows me to sort of have the ability to even hang out with you today.
And you're Iranian, correct?
Correct. So originally, my parents, I grew up in California. I was about 2 when we left Iran. And so I don't remember too much, but I actually do have the memory of sort of the bombs coming down as we were in conflict with Iraq. But to go back and answer your question, you know, you said the U.S. isn't in the greatest shape that it has been, perhaps. I think if you look at the actual numbers in terms of what's really happening, I think, you know, the thought of what's happening doesn't actually align with reality. I think when we look at social media, we're constantly bombarded with these images of, you know, conflict and rioting and these sorts of things. But if you actually look at the numbers in terms of violent crimes in the U.S., they've dramatically declined from 10 years ago. This is one instance where our illusions and visions of what's happening does not actually align with reality. And so that's really information that you can simply Google, you know, U.S. violent crimes chart, click on images, and you will see a downward trend. But I agree with you that the images that we're being fed or that we are consuming doesn't really, you know, you'd think that it's such a violent place and it's such a crazy place, especially coming from Dubai where we don't see any of that. I still think that one of the greatest problems with the U.S. is that of image control. I mean, ultimately, in our lifetime, I don't see the powers necessarily switching. Here's the thing. Are there dominant market players that are doing really well in business? Sure, yeah, China and the concept of BRICS and all that's happening. But at the end of the day, the concept and idea of capitalism was defined by the US. We're still under that currency, that setup, that structure. Is it fair? Maybe, maybe not. We can argue that. But those that create the rules tend to create them to then never actually lose that particular game. Will it be the same? Was it the same 100 years ago? Absolutely not. In 100 years from now, will it be different? Perhaps. But this is just what we have now. So going back to your answer, yeah, I think the ultimate ideal is to create a space and perhaps a nationality for kids to become better educated and have access to the better jobs. And I don't see that really happening in places like China or otherwise quite yet.
I mean, look, it's a fair enough answer, and it's an interesting answer, and you're backing it up quite well with figures. I'm not familiar with the actual statistics at the moment.
Invite me back. Let's chat about that again.
I will, actually, and I was thinking about that, so we're on the same page.
Sweet.
Let's talk about retirement. You mentioned retirement as well, because I think we can talk about the political, you know, I'm half Russian, you're vouching for the U.S. We can go deep on this topic.
Let's do it. You're
coming back on the show. We'll do it again.
I want a chess table. You know, let's go. Let's
chess get it table. Let's do it. I love chess. Retirement.
Yeah.
How do you help people retire in the U.S. so people can get a better understanding? Because, yes, the options are limited in the GCC. We do expect there to be more changes and more benefits when it comes to pension funds. But how do you help people?
What is the concept of retirement? Ultimately, it's the idea of I can settle at old age with my, you know, with a body that's just not as able. I cannot physically get up and uproot. And until we get to a place where people are guaranteed the ability to stay, and normally that comes through as a nationality whereby nobody can then kick you out. And if and until we're there, I don't think the concept of, you know, it's a very tricky question because we have a way of dancing around things within the GCC. But again, I think the perhaps the ultimate way to retire is to know that you don't ever have to leave. So the GCC is brilliant in that a lot of people from conflicted regions, countries nearby have come here. They've built a great sort of life for themselves, but it ultimately ends up being a stepping stone to the West because ultimately, you know, nobody wants to be in a place where they're forced to go back to Syria, Iran, Pakistan, especially if your kids are not acclimated to this kind of a lifestyle. They'll never know what it's like for you to go back home. So
I'm getting goosebumps, actually, as you're talking about this, because, yes, that is, imagine that you were born and raised here, for example, and then all of a sudden you have to go back someplace else in a conflicted region.
It doesn't happen, but there are examples. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone yeah. knows of that one person that lost their job or what have you. So I'm not here to provide a solution necessarily to that. I'm just saying that that is a dynamic. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why people will ultimately want to do this program. Maybe even take on the nationality, come back by virtue, you know, if a Syrian does this, we need to have a let's be real moment.
Sure.
When a Syrian comes back with the U.S. passport, they're now magically getting nearly double their salary.
Absolutely.
So these sorts of things are pertinent, and I'm happy we're discussing them. And perhaps I'll provide one solution. It may or may not be the best solution, but this is what we've got right now with the U.S.
I mean, it's a fascinating conversation. We can honestly sit and talk about this for so long, but I think we've made some great points. Really, really good to have you on the show.
I appreciate it.
You'll be back, right?
I hope so. If you have me back.
If we both don't get in trouble after this conversation. No, I'm just messing with you. Don't worry. You're safe. You're safe. There was a little moment where you looked worried there, but don't worry. It's all good.
I took a step back, right? It is what it is.
No, hey, look, I mean, we're creating conversations, and we do love and appreciate the UAE. It's an amazing place. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, back home, I wouldn't get the salary. Well, home to me is the UAE. But if I were, you know, I'm Palestinian, Russian, Ukrainian with a Jordanian passport. If I were to go back to Jordan or Ukraine or Russia or Palestine, I would not be getting the same salary. So a lot of opportunities here, a lot of challenges. And it's okay to talk about both, right?
Discussion is helpful, I feel like. So
absolutely, absolutely. Thank you guys for watching. Stream us on smashy.tv or listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, Anghami, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And we'll see you tomorrow.